Nostalgia. Men's and women's fine vintage clothing, timepieces, and collectible jewelry. Wardrobing theater, theme parties, murder mysteries, rental, retail.
Are we rolling into this like we've done before?
Are we?
Sure, why not?
We're rolling into it. Here we go. Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of...
Marathon Chat.
This is NPR.
I'm going to take the lead in this because I came up with this idea. So we really don't have a lot to talk about.
Oh, we always have something to talk about.
Well, but you see, he cut me off there.
I'm sorry.
I was right about to pay it off. Not a lot to talk about actual marathon news, aside from what we announced at the sci-fi marathon, October 17th and 18th, I believe it is.
Something like that.
Whatever dates are closest. Yeah, and that we have Horror Marathon, the 7th annual 24-hour Horror Marathon. Mm-hmm. We currently have two titles booked. That is Shock Value, the movie, which is a compilation of USC student films from the 70s, including one of John Carpenter's student films and one of Dan O'Bannon's student films, and a 35mm print of The Keep.
Yes.
Michael Mann's Nazi supernatural cult classic from the 80s.
Starring Magneto.
Yeah. But more on that
later
in coming months.
Much
okay,
later.
So the hook for this, let me explain this to you. Like many things I am involved in, this is a shameless ripoff of something somebody else is doing. But what they did was probably a shameless ripoff too.
So is Windows.
Yes. We are basically the Windows of podcasts. We are the bootleg version of Windows of podcasts. Yes. So a couple months ago, some of you in listener land might know this, Henry Rollins, one of my personal heroes, started doing a podcast with his personal assistant, Heidi. And if they're listening right now, feel free to sue us. That's cool. It's Kevin Carr, C-A-R-R, Archway Drive.
Just starting it off with a feud for Stephen King.
I would never feud with Henry.
Ben Werner Herzog.
Are you kidding me?
Henry Rollins.
I'd cave. I'd go hug him before anything happened. So they started a podcast, and the concept was simple, but I think it was really cool in that they would show up, press record, and Heidi, his personal assistant, would bring up a topic related to his career.
Okay.
And so it was like the first full one they did was talk about your years with the Black Flag. Mm-hmm. He had no prep for it, and he would just start talking about it. And it was kind of cool in that a lot of the stories about Black Flag that he had told before were all in pieces, but this was a nice hour and a half where he just talked about that, and he told all the stories he could, and she asked questions, and blah, 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 and they did one on the Rollins Band, they did one on when he recorded a single with RuPaul, which was only like a half hour, but it was a cool story, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to apply that concept to what we do here?
I've never recorded anything with RuPaul.
No, but we'll work on that.
I would, though.
I have my hopes. That'd I would, too. Cool. I think we have something to shoot for. So I approached Kevin and I said, hey, look, we've told so many stories over the years about the marathons and the old days and the middle days and all that. Why don't we get together and just focus it? Say, let's go in order and try to collect all the stories that we can and maybe some new ones and some context into one cohesive form.
Yeah.
To tell the history of our history with the marathons, and by extension, in some ways, the history of the marathons. So the concept for today is Kevin and I are both going to talk about how we discovered the marathons
our
back in the old
time.
Days of the Drexel North. Our first time. Popping the cherry.
Wow.
And we're only going to focus on the Drexel North years up until 1995. That was 87 through 95 was when it ran there. Hmm. Tell some stories. Hopefully, some of these you've heard before, but hopefully some of them will be new.
Technically, it was 86, wasn't it?
87.
86 was the first sci-fi, I thought.
87 was first sci-fi. Mm-hmm. I'm right. We don't have a lot of time. Right. Let's go.
Continue.
Don't question my shit on this. I know more than you, even though I wasn't there. So anyway...
Now he's questioning it.
Kevin. No. I'm just getting annoyed that you would question my genius. So Kevin is going to talk about the beginning of the marathons for him, and then he'll switch off to me, and then we'll kind of try to go in as much of chronological order as we can through the end of the Drexel North years, and just tell stories about the marathons and what sticks out to us, and maybe this will form a very cohesive picture of those years, at least through our eyes, for you. And maybe some of you will get a kick out of hearing me say some of these things in a focused area, and maybe some of you will get the kick out of hearing Kevin say those things. Maybe some of you will say, what the fuck was the Drexel North? Why do I care?
If you don't know what the Drexel North was,
you're out of luck.
You,
and if this if this goes well, maybe we'll continue it the next time, whatever, and cover like the Rife Center years and go on from that. There are a lot of stories to tell, and we always end up telling these stories, but they're always little bits and pieces. So I thought, let's get them together. Let's do something focused, and maybe, just maybe, this will focus us, and we won't go off on as many tangents. So that being said, I'm going to hand it over to Kevin, and he can begin his tale.
The first marathon I ever went to, and this is why I this is why I thought that the sci-fi started in 1986 was because the first marathon I ever went to was in October, was the first horror marathon in October of 1987. I thought I was, cause then 88 was the third sci-fi, which I think would have been the one too much.
Horror number one was 1988.
Was it 1988?
Yes, it was. Oh, okay. Because sci-fi two was in 1988.
Okay.
You know, we're running out of time, so just start telling the story.
Cool. Okay. So anyways, I was, it was the first horror marathon. And I didn't actually know about it at all. And I had a friend, his name's TJ. And I still keep in touch with him. I've actually dragged him to a couple marathons later on down the road. I mean, like when we were adults and had kids and all that kind of thing. Before I started bringing my kids. We left during, Irreversible together because we that movie about killed us. But
thanks, Kevin.
Anyways, TJ calls me up one day and it was a Saturday. So it was the Saturday of the marathon. And he's like, hey, do you want to go to, there's this movie thing that I'm at. Do you want to come with me to this? And this was, and I have to admit, we sort of played a little fast and loose with the rules. This was, of course, at the Drexel North when it was, well, and I don't even think it was filled then at that time because, you know, it was the first horror marathon. And they'd had success with two sci-fi before that. And he had apparently won tickets on the radio to this horror marathon, and he took a date.
I like him already.
Major fuck up number one. So they went on a date. I don't even remember who it was. He told me, but I don't remember who it was. And I don't know when they had gone, but it was probably noonish to two or something like that they went. And he apparently then had to take her home. And he had the ticket, and he's like, well, I only stayed for a couple movies. Do you want to come with me to go see this? And I said, yeah, sure, let's do that. And I just used the ticket to get in. So yeah, I know I technically didn't. Did not buy the ticket, and it was before they were really getting authoritative with stamping hands and everything like that. So we went, and I only stayed for, I think it was three movies, two and a half, basically, because we came in, I believe, in the middle of Dracula, Prince of Darkness, which was...
That was horror number three. No, that was 1990.
That was number one.
No, that was Horror of Dracula played at number
one.
That
was Horror of... Then maybe it was
this
horror
is going to turn... you should
well, because I, was, okay, I wasn't there for the opening...
The tag for this now will not be Marathon Drexel North History. It'll be Joe's Trivia Skills. Horror of Dracula showed at horror number one.
Horror of Dracula. Okay, so then that's what it was. And the reason...
By the way, but just to tell you, we didn't do any prep for this.
No, none.
This is all freestyle. So if it gets shaggy, sorry.
Sorry, shaggy. It's like me. I won't finish that statement. Anyways, so the reason I actually don't remember which one it was because we came in the middle of it. He had come and picked me up and we came out there and we went to see this and we sat down and started watching the movie. And I thought it was great because what people don't realize now, I mean, I'm sure they do, especially if you're my age, but if you're, you know, 18 or 20, you don't realize back in the 80s, if you wanted to see some of these movies, you just kind of had to wait until they showed up on TV somewhere.
Yeah.
And even though they're VHS, you were limited to what the video store nearby you had. If there was a Blockbuster, or at the time it was called a Video Town.
Yeah.
And there were small mom and pop video, but if they didn't have Horror of Dracula, which a lot of them didn't, you're kind of SOL. You had to catch it on late night TV somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
And so this was a real treat. I mean, now you can find Horror of Dracula anywhere. And with the internet and YouTube and pirating, or even just with Netflix, you can usually, I think Horror of Dracula, you can get on Warner Archive and get all those Hammer
movies. And there was, even if you weren't like a big technical person, there was... I think psychologically even a noticeable difference between seeing something in a theater and seeing it on VHS.
Well, hugely different. Simply
compared
because,
to now.
Well, especially, because your TVs were 25 inches, 27 inches diagonal. So you didn't have widescreen, and there were tube TVs, and everything was pan and scan.
Yeah.
So if you caught it, even if you could find a VHS, it was unlikely in the extreme you'd find a letterbox VHS in your local video.
Yeah. Well,
store.
And even like I remember as a kid,
and no one broadcasted letterbox.
No, no. Except, I remember as a kid watching things on VHS, not knowing about what widescreen was even at that point.
Yeah.
But I even remember then thinking, oh, there's a difference between seeing this here and seeing it in a theater.
Yeah.
Because it's of all the things you talked about, and that does make a difference, you know.
It does. Well, and nowadays the even just home theaters, you can get a 50-inch TV and a good sound system and a Blu-ray and get to see it widescreen, and it's still not the same.
It was the default setting too back then, because you had decades of people being trained that the primary way to see a movie was with an audience in a theater for that communal aspect, and that's changed quite a bit over the years.
Oh yeah, definitely. And so this was. And like, even though I saw half the movie, came in halfway through, and it, of course, had Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing as Van Helsing. And it was really cool to see it because, like I said, this was the kind of thing I could only catch on like Night Owl Theater or whatever, or some Saturday afternoon if you're lucky, because you'd find it. And so we're watching the movie, and this is where I was sold, was when at the end of the film, spoiler alert, when Van Helsing comes in,
Dracula dies.
To dispatch Dracula, they're in this. They're like in a dining room or something. And Van Helsing comes in with his cross.
Oh yeah.
And the audience erupts in cheers.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, I just never experienced that, because when you go see, even when you see Star Wars, when I saw Star Wars in 1977, there was the excitement, but. First run movie, you're supposed to be a little more restrained, and just to have the entire audience go bonkers over this movie that was from 1958. So you're talking 30 years beforehand.
Yeah,
I never experienced something like that, and from that moment on, I was sold. And then I think the next movie was The Howling.
It was right around then.
Yeah, and then I can't remember if we.
Yes, it's sad. I remember the running order of number one, which I was not at.
I'm actually trying to remember what the next movie, because I know we sat through the whole of The Howling, which is a great movie.
Yeah,
that's a lot of fun.
The Howling, because in the evening they played,
and there was something
House
else.
On Haunted Hill, The Haunting, The Howling, and I think after The Howling was Lair of the White Worm.
Okay, I did not see that one. So maybe House on Haunted Hill was next.
In Emerjo. Yeah. With the skeleton.
Did they run the skeleton?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't see that, no. I forget whatever it was that was between those or after The Howling.
Someone's getting old, they don't remember their past.
But no, I remember seeing The Howling. And then, of course, by that time, it was late. I mean, it was pretty late by that time. And you know, so we'd sat through two movies and of course, the half of the Dracula. And my friend TJ's like, oh, I got to go home. And I'm like, bruh. And I felt robbed because I only got that 2.5 movies.
Yeah, why didn't you stay?
Well, I mean, he was my ride.
Yeah.
And I was over the Drexel North. I didn't have my car. I was only 16 at the time.
That's true. You were only...
I was 17. If it was 88, I was 17. Man. So, I mean, it was... And then from that point on, I was like... as I left, you know, of course, this is, again, long before email.
Yeah.
I, you know, put my name on the mailing list, which, you know, that it's more a cursory, you know, courtesy now.
Yeah.
But, you know, the mailing list was the only way to know when the next one
was. Yeah.
Unless you were, you know, lurking the Drexel North or...
Oh, that was magic.
Yeah.
That's one thing that we have lost in this day and age is...
The unexpected, the Christmas morning arrival.
The flyer shows up in the mail. Yeah. And that was your first word, unless you obsessively called the theater like me.
Yeah.
But that's my part of the story. So anyway.
Well, yeah. So anyway, so then this is kind of like I said, a 1-2 punch for then the first. So then the first full one I went to, of course, I was waiting with bated breath. And then in the springtime, they had the sci-fi. I think that's when it was. It's always the springtime. I forget what time of year it was. Probably March. They're doing March.
It varied. Yeah. But.
And I got the flyer, and of course it had Inframan on there.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
That was ironically the year it played at like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And I fell asleep during it when it showed. But I saw it, and then I went right to TJ. I said, we got to go to this. And I convinced him to go. And he was an ardent supporter with me. So he'd go to a lot of them. And it's just, he was not prepared for the all night experience that night. And what we did, of course, back then. So it was the third sci-fi. And so it was pretty full. I don't know if it was sold out yet. but it was pretty doggone full.
Yeah.
And that was when you could bring food in because it was an 800-seat theater and they made plenty of money off the door.
Oh, yeah. You could bring anything in.
We went and we got Subways, which we found out was not a good idea because they get soggy after a while. But, you know, we brought a cooler. I think we brought a cooler of Dr. Pepper.
Yeah. I did that my first time. Yeah.
Which is even then at that time I was still 17. Even on my 17-year-old stomach, that's pretty rough.
That's what I found out quickly.
But what was really cool is right across from the Drexel North was a G.D. Ritzy's, if you remember that place.
Absolutely.
The greatest hot dogs on the planet, and they had awesome. So we'd a lot of times just run across the street and get some regular food if you got tired of pizza and nachos. So we went and got hot dogs and french fries. And stuff.
Or pretzels.
Yeah.
Or chili.
But I went to that one, and I believe they showed 2001 there, and they showed The Blob.
Both blobs.
They showed both blobs. There was sort of this, I don't know whether Bruce was meaning to do themes of something falling to earth and causing problems because Kronos was there as well.
Yeah.
Which of course the giant electrical monster from the 50s and Killer Clowns from Outer Space also involved an asteroid fall.
The Time Machine and Terminator. And
was that on there too? Yeah, they all blend together.
That was a really great lineup.
It was a fantastic, and of course then that sold me.
Well,
that,
all those. The first 5-6 years of the marathons, it's like, how do you fuck this up?
Well, but you also look at it.
They're all great.
It was in the... So, yeah, Terminator. You're like, oh, yeah, the Terminator was only 4 years before that.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm 5 years, four and a half.
Pre-T2 at this point.
Yeah, so it was... Terminator was a recent release. And you got to think, again, you look at it here, where you got... sci-fi, yeah, you can throw a Metropolis now and then. But generally, science fiction films start in the 50s. You get a couple of them in the 40s.
Popular sci-fi reached its real genesis point in the 50s.
Generally, if you get something from before that, it's the one outlier. You get Trip to the Moon or you get Metropolis. But, you know, back then, so you're talking about you had a pool of 35 years to pull from, as opposed to now you have a pool of 60, 65 years?
Yeah.
There's a lot to draw from. And so you'd pack these lineups and for people who would complain, oh, we don't have enough stuff from the 70s and the 80s. It was nothing but that. And it was, cause you had the 50s and they throw in some 60s and then the 70s, that's all you had left. You could not do stuff from the 90s. You could not do stuff from the 2000s. And that was a fantastic lineup. That was also, it was there was this guy who would talk, behind us, and he was really annoying because he was sort of like this. He'd be like the playground bully, not the jock bully, but the playground bully from an old 80s TV show. He's kind of overweight and he was very Bubba looking ish. And he was sitting there after Killer Clowns when they shoot the guy with the ice cream gun and he puts the chair and then the little clown comes and puts the chair on the guy's head.
Yeah.
He literally shouts out, "They put a cherry on him." And at that point, TJ turns around to him and says, "Yeah, we got that." But the guy, 2001 played, and the guy started goofing at and he actually realized nobody was goofing on 2001, and he shut up during it. Long before we even got out of Ape Country.
Yeah,
he shut up, or maybe he went to dinner.
Yeah.
At G.D. Ritzy's. But yeah, that was my first. So I was sold. And I mean, that was again the heyday of the Drexel North where you can bring food in and you could, the floor got really sticky.
Yes. Especially when the bread started. But that story will come soon.
That's a whole nother story. But yeah, that was my first story.
Okay. My story, and some of you have heard parts of this before, but I'm going to put it all together now, possibly for the first time.
Yeah.
My origin story for the marathons. In 1988, I started getting my hair cut at a place in German Village called Head of the Park. And it,
I don't know why I laughed.
It was a barbershop that was right at the head of Schiller Park. Mm-hmm. They've since moved a few blocks down, but the guy who ran it, well, I shouldn't say ran it, the guy who was one of the people who ran it, who still helps to run it today, was fairly hip, and he used to pick up copies of Hoot Magazine.
Yes.
Hoot Magazine, for those of you who don't remember or have no idea what we're talking about, I'm holding a copy in my hand right now. Yeah, that was terrible.
Is that a vintage one? Is this the one that popped your cherry, bloody the panties? No.
This is far later. My cherry had already been popped. This copy I'm holding is from 1993. Hoot magazine, if you don't remember, was created by Irv Oslin, who was kind of a local gadfly slash entrepreneur slash writer, and back in 1987 was when Irv started this. Back then, pre-internet, there were a lot of comic strips that did not run in town.
Yeah.
And Hoot's big appeal was you could get some of those strips and you would get like week and a half runs of them. So yeah. One of the famous ones I discovered through Hoot was Zippy the Pinhead.
Mm-hmm.
And Zippy the Pinhead is this absurdist strip that runs in some markets around the
nation.
It was
too fringe to actually show up in the Dispatch.
It's still not in the Dispatch today. Or the CJ. Yeah. God, the Citizen Journal. Yeah. So basically, they would run cartoons like that. And there were some that you saw, like Mother Goose and Grimm.
Well, I see you got Bizarro down there.
Yeah. Mother Goose and Grimm ran in the Dispatch, but you'd get like the whole run, or you'd get some stuff that might not run. And there were some local cartoons, and there were some papers. And it was a real kind of countercultural biweekly, I think it was when it first started. Yeah. It was like a countercultural biweekly cartoon humor. Newspaper.
There wasn't a whole lot of, I would say, there's not a whole lot of meat to Hoot.
No,
but it was
no,
all this
no.
fringe weird stuff. They had Joe Bob's column.
That was the big thing in the back. This copy from 1993, Joe Bob goes to the drive-in reviewing Children of the Corn 2. Mm. And it was the only place in town that would run Joe Bob's syndicated column.
Because he always gave the breakdown of how many breasts.
The drive-in totals, yeah. So all this stuff. Running into this at 88 was when I saw my first issue, so I would have been 11. Running into this for the first time was like a little peek into the adult world. My parents were almost 40 when they had me, so I was always raised in kind of classic culture in some ways, even though I kept in touch with like modern culture. I loved Masters of the Universe and all the 80s stuff that kids liked.
Yeah.
But at the same time, too, I was always heavily influenced by that classic culture my parents grew up with. So running into this was kind of like a neat little gateway further into the adult world. And in 1988, I was sitting in Head of the Park about to get my hair cut. And Steve, the guy who picked up these issues of Hoot, he would always have like two or three at a time. And he put them there for the customers to read. And I picked up one and I looked at the cover and there was Marvin the Martian on the cover.
Ooh.
And I obviously knew who Marvin the Martian was. And the headline under it, I will never forget this, said, Insomniacs Invade the Drexel North.
I think I remember. Wait, that was 88?
88.
Maybe I didn't.
Second sci-fi.
Okay, I didn't see that one.
I had no idea what an insomniac was at that point.
But you wanted to be
But I thought, well, this sounds interesting. So I opened it up and I discovered the article that would begin to change my life. Mm-hmm. And one of the hallmarks of Hoot, because they were local and because this was how you got word around, was that Hoot, and specifically Irv, would always give the marathons very good treatment. Sci-fi almost always had the cover as long as it was running at the Drexel North. Horror, I don't think ever had the cover, but the coverage was generous all the time. Mm-hmm. Hoot was like a real friend to the marathons, and I can't overestimate the impact Hoot had on the marathons back then.
Oh, yeah.
And this is from stories I've heard, but also just from experiencing it somewhat, this was where you went in a lot of ways for news about the marathons.
Well, but it was also it preceded the marathons healthy.
Yes.
Healthily? Is that a right word?
Healthily.
As opposed to like the Dispatch would usually, sometimes they'd run, if it got to the point where they'd run articles, I didn't know if they ran one for every one, or even Columbus Alive or the other paper, but they always did it like, hey, this is what this is, this weekend you have this.
It was a great, it was the perfect combination of a countercultural paper and a countercultural event at a countercultural theater at a time when there were enough people in the city that were really receptive to that. And it was great.
This 88 would have been the huge expansion of the multiplex.
Yeah. And the beginning of kind of the changing of Columbus, the slight expansion of Columbus out past what had been more of an insular city for a while. So I see this paper, I open it up, and inside is Irv Oslin writing about the second annual 24-hour Ohio, not even Ohio at that time, the second annual 24-hour science fiction marathon at the Drexel North. And I'm reading this article and it's like, wow, people do this? Mm-hmm. People sit for 24 hours in a theater watching sci-fi movies, and I recognize some of these names. I've seen some of these movies like on TV or on, you know, in syndication or whatever. And I thought, wow, that sounds interesting. That sounds like I wonder what that's like. Because, well, as a kid, I liked movies a lot. I've talked about that before. Yeah. But it was always
that you liked movies.
I hope I've made that clear over the years. But it was more of a situation like a lot of kids are, where you like movies. You like watching them. It's fun. It's like, hey, movie's cool.
Yeah.
But.
And it's like getting to see him in a theater.
Yeah.
That's the lure.
But you don't always think about like, I love movies. Mm-hmm. You just accept it. Like, I like seeing movies. It's cool. Now I'm going to go play.
Yeah.
So I read this article about sci-fi and I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. Kind of let it go because movies weren't like a huge passion. I just like movies, yeah. You know? Then in the next issue of Hoot, they had an article by a guy named Mike Cole, and it was called Over and Way Out, and it was Mike Cole's review of the second annual 24-hour science fiction marathon. So now finally I'm reading about someone who's gone there, and it's a really cool, for the constraints, for like, you know, a page of a tabloid like this, a really cool in-depth exploration of what it means to sit through 24 hours. And I remember reading this, and I would reread this over the years, because it's like a blow-by-blow account of going through, and it talks about how it's weird when you get tired in the middle of the night, and how this cup of coffee he drank at 6 in the morning was like smooth and hot and really woke him back up, how Bruce attempted a best pillow contest and it bombed, and it was just, it really filled in some of the fabric of the event, and it was like, well, this is really neat. And I remember at the end of this article, which I have a copy of somewhere, he said, there are rumors that there are plans underway for a 24-hour horror marathon in the fall. Just think about it. The Bride of the Living Drexel, or the, you know, the blah, 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 blah. And he pitched out a few names. Mm-hmm. At the second 24-hour sci-fi marathon, which I was not at, but I have known through stories later, that was when Bruce asked the crowd, how would you guys like to do a 24-hour horror marathon in the fall? And the response was good. And so began the planning. And this is where we really get into my history with the Drexel North, because then that fall, I continued to pick up the copies of Hoot that Steve has at the barbershop. And I remember the issue that fall, and on the front, it had a parody of the Shroud of Turin, except it was the Shroud of something else. I don't know. I have this somewhere at home.
Yeah.
But it was a parody of the Shroud of Turin, and I opened the paper up. And this was probably like end of September, early October. Open the paper up, and on the front inside cover, it says, Night of the Living Drexel. And it's Irv writing about the first annual 24-hour horror marathon. And he breaks down the films and everything.
Did he mention my name, that I was going to be there?
He said, Kevin Carr will be there live in person, not yet 18. And 4 or 5 pages then in was the full page ad for the horror marathon.
Yeah.
And it was basically a reproduction of the flyer, if you've ever seen that. And the flyer for the first horror marathon was very Spartan. It was the ad art from Squirm and some little, you know, tchotchkes around that. But it was basically the titles of the films and a description for each film, and that was it. Now, you have to understand, when I was a kid, I was not allowed to watch R-rated horror films. Mm-hmm. But I grew up on the steady diet of classic Universal, classic AIP, Amicus, all those things. So I was pretty well-versed in
PG.
And things that push the boundaries a bit. Mm-hmm. So to read this list and to read this ad, it was like the siren song from Beyond the Veil. It called it because that first horror marathon is such a great, like almost like a history of horror lineup in that you've got Frankenstein, The House on Haunted Hill, The Haunting, The Howling.
That's what it was. It was The Haunting.
Yes.
That I also got to see, as was Island of Lost Souls.
Island of Lost Souls, Horror Great of Dracula, classics. Lair of the White Worm, Evil Dead 2, Hills Have Eyes, Return of the Living Dead, The Vampire Lovers, and a little movie that, yes, the first time I read the ad, and it took me years afterwards to pronounce this correctly, a little plug for a film that I thought was called Suspira. And the descriptions were so great and lurid, the ones that Bruce wrote. Think about this when you're, especially in that age, when you're 11, and you're reading these descriptions of this movies, and they're like, the forbidden fruit. And it's like, whoa. And I love that, how, you know, he always played up in those early flyers and ads, like, after, we're going to try to restrict the really graphic stuff until after midnight because this is the really nasty stuff. And kids were a ticket option at that point, you know?
Yeah.
And as a, so as an 11-year-old reading about this, it's like, holy fuck. I would love to go to this. This is what I've been waiting for a while.
Well, and I will, for those who have complained about certain shocking titles that have appeared, and I mentioned Serbian film early, but, you know, stuff like, oh gosh, you know, Irreversible and, and Kill List and stuff like that. Playing what was scheduled at like, was it 6:45 in the morning was The Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah.
So there was your rape movie right in the first lineup.
Well, and it
and for church, you could go watch that and then go to church.
Yeah. And there was, and Hills Have Eyes was only 10 years old at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was there's always been a level of graphic content.
Yeah.
But reading about that just knocked me out. And I thought, God damn, I would love to go to this. But as you said, as I have said many times before, I thought there's no way in hell I'll be able to go to this because my parents would never let me.
Yeah.
Now, years later, after I'd sold my soul to these things, before I tried to buy it back finally, my mom, when I mentioned this to her, said, oh, well, one of your sisters could have taken you. That would have been fine. And I just kicked myself because I missed the real glory prime years when the event began.
Well, here's my question, though. Would they have really let your sister take you to go see The Hills Have Eyes?
I don't know.
Or is she saying that in retrospect, knowing that you've fallen so far down the rabbit hole?
No. I think
you've eaten the cake.
I think she would have allowed me if my sister was there. Mm. At the same time, too, though, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here. They always make a big deal in the early ads for the horror marathons about asking kids to leave after midnight. Was that actually enforced that much, or was that more of a general cover your ass guideline?
I think that was more CY. If I recall, there weren't a whole lot of younger kids, but then again, you got to realize I was a teenager when I was going. So to me, a younger kid would have been a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
But I do remember somebody brought, because I remember when there was a contest at some point. And I don't even remember if it was sci-fi or horror.
Was this Kill the Kid?
No.
Okay.
No. But it was something where it was being, and these kids in there, and they did BB's. You remember BB's Kids?
Oh, yeah.
They were playing BB's Kids. That was their costume. But of course, that had BB's Kids wasn't.
It's Bebe's, actually.
Is it Bebe's? I'm just the voice of Urban Columbus. But so, and I remember I must have been in either high school or college at the time. And I remember thinking those kids were, so maybe 12, maybe 10, 8. So they were there doing the costume contest, but I don't know. I don't recall anybody enforcing to kick anybody.
Well, and
out.
I remember it was only in the first few years of the horror, if you read the ads, that there was like a notice that we will ask underage kids to leave.
Well, I mean, Lair of the White Worm premiered after midnight and Hills Have Eyes, you know, and even arguably Suspiria and The Return of the Living Dead. Notorious to a certain degree.
Yeah. Well, here's the weird thing. All this happens in 1988. Hoot Magazine, discovering the marathons. To this day, I have that full page ad from Hoot for the first horror marathon hanging in a frame I stole from Bandcamp back when I was in high school because it was a nice frame. But then I forgot about the marathons. It's really strange because I would hear about them. I'd still pick up Hoot now and again.
Was
when
it
I got
like
my haircut.
A sour grapes thing? Where you're just like, I can't go, so I'm pretend they don't exist.
I was 11, and you know, film was something I really liked, but it was more like, wow, Batman's coming out in 1989. I really want to go see that. It wasn't like I paid attention to every new movie that came out. Things just filtered in.
Yeah.
See, I was convinced I was going to be a baseball player at that point.
See, I guess that's one thing where you and I differ, and the way we come to it, where you said, well, I like movies, but I was always crazy into movies.
Yeah.
And I remember as a kid, in fifth grade, you know, knowing when movies were coming out. Even then, like sixth, seventh grade, I had a friend of mine named Brian who was like, oh yeah, Kevin like knows directors and grips and who was the looper in this movie. And he was right too. I mean, I didn't know who was Key Grip on Empire Strikes Back or whatever, you know, but I did know all the directors. And even all the way through high school, that's how I was.
Well, the weird thing for me was most of my time at that age was spent collecting baseball cards.
Okay.
Watching baseball because I was convinced I was going to be a pitcher for the Red Sox someday. Yeah. Insert laugh. I didn't realize genetics had conspired against me at that point, but
you could have been.
But you can dream. You can dream. Hey, yeah.
Football player. You could have been the Bo Johnson of Columbus.
Yes.
Bo Jackson.
Yeah.
See, that shows how much I know about sports.
Yeah. But that, I mean, a lot of my life was based around sports at that time, and I liked movies as well.
Mm-hmm.
Marathons profoundly changed that.
Yeah.
So as a result,
marathons robbed us of the greatest pitcher in American baseball.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Thanks, marathons. Thanks a whole fucking lot. So because my interests lied elsewhere, and because I was ending grade school and about to go into high school, I would keep up. I'd see the ads, and it was kind of fun. But for me, movies weren't this overwhelming obsession.
Yeah.
They were just something I liked doing. And in the moment, I saw the horror marathon ad for number one and thought, that would be really fucking cool. But after that, I just kind of saw occasionally and I thought, oh, the marathons. Oh, yeah. I remember in high school, when I first started high school, I would there were a couple ads for the marathons I would cut out of papers, or I'd get a flyer and I'd hang it, because I was in the percussion section of the marching band, I'd hang it on this wall we had of various goofy stuff.
Mm.
Inside the percussion room. And we would always look at it like, oh yeah, the movie marathons. Oh yeah, that thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was more of something like a distant thing that happened, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was never anything that I made a concerted effort to go to or to try to go to at that point. Until 1993. Spring 1993, I read about the upcoming 7th annual 24-hour sci-fi marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And my best friend in high school, Josh, approached me in religion class one day at Bishop Reedy High School.
That's just the great beginning.
Isn't it great?
Story.
Yeah. This is a real Scorsese sacred and the profane type story. Religion and movies. It's the twin diopter of life. So Josh approaches me and he said, hey, did you see the lineup for this sci-fi marathon that's going on? This was probably like 2, maybe 3 weeks before it happened.
Okay.
And I said, oh yeah, I saw the ad, I think, in Hoot. And he said, I'm thinking of going. Do you want to go? And I'm just sitting back and I said, oh, maybe. I don't let me think about it. And the next day I told him, yeah, sure, I'll go. What the hell? Because he was my best friend. I wanted to hang out with him. You know, I mean, it was something that he was really into. And I thought, well, let's do it.
Sure.
I bought a ticket. He got a free ticket because his mom like knew someone that worked at a radio station for a giveaway.
Mm.
And we brought one of our other friends with us. And my expectations were, oh, this will be kind of a fun thing to do. So we get to the weekend and I see the story in the Dispatch. And this, talk about weird history, the story in the Columbus Dispatch that weekend in the Weekender section was there were rumors that the marathons might not continue. Because the theater, that was when the Drexel North finally had its lease start to become like a, I forget if it was a month by month at that point, but there were questions about the lease to the theater.
Yeah.
And there were questions about the direction of the marathon, because the marathon was huge at that point. People forget this, but I have a tape from 1992 Sci-Fi in which Jeff Frank mentions to someone, we're thinking about getting a bigger theater because we're expanding so much.
Jesus.
I swear to God.
Well, it would, the Sci-Fi would sell out every year.
It started to get that way, yeah.
And it was 800-seat theater. They probably sold 700 to 750 tickets to sell it out.
Yeah.
And the Horror Marathon, I can't remember whether the Horror Marathon actually sold out or it came close, it was packed.
There were several years. They sold out when Patty Mullen was the guest in year three. I don't think they sold out after that. But to give you an idea, and this isn't speaking out of turn, but I have a tape from 1991, mm-hmm. which was the year Brian Usna and Rolf Konevsky were the two guests.
Yeah.
And Bruce is talking about the attendance, and he says, slightly disappointing, there were only like 580 people,
mm-hmm.
which is just bonkers when you think about it today, that 580 was considered to be disappointing
only.
Attendance, you know?
Only.
The next year with Stuart Gordon, they didn't sell out, and that was considered mildly disappointing, and it's like, that's still 600-some people in a theater. Jesus Christ.
It was huge. And I think a lot of it, like I said, it's the availability was such a rare event.
Yes, it was. And for a while it became, Rolf Konevsky talks about this in the special edition DVD of There's Nothing Out There, which he had the Midwest premiere of at the 1991 Horror Marathon.
Yeah.
And he said, at that point, this event, sci-fi and horror, got the reputation that if you want to premiere a film or test out a film in the Midwest, you go there.
Yeah.
So that's where that was. So we go to the marathon, spring 1993, and I still vividly remember rounding that corner on High Street where the woods are and coming around on the Drexel North. I had never been in the Drexel North. Ironically enough, when I was a kid, my dad used to take me to the old Wizard of Comics, which was where the soldiery is, or the guard tower,
The guard tower is way out on Tremont.
Soldiery, which is in the back of the Laughing Ogre.
Yeah.
that's where Wizard of Comics used to be. So I was around the Drexel North quite a bit when I was a kid. I just never looked over and thought, that's a movie theater, because it didn't register to me.
Because it's huge.
Yeah, I just thought, it's some place. I'm here to get comic books at the other place. And I remember rounding the corner and thinking, oh, wait, that's the Drexel North. Holy shit. And we got in line, and, you know, we're like three quarters of the way back, and we're like, well, this is intense. There's people wrapped around the theater.
Yeah.
Like, haven't been to a movie event like this before.
If you didn't get there, I remember we'd have to leave the house, because I go pick people up.
Yeah.
And because when I was in the heyday, I was bringing friends from band. I brought a girlfriend. I brought two girlfriends to this over the years. And, you know, I bring friends from band, and we get a row of seven or eight people who'd climb into there. And if you got there too late, and I mean, you'd have to get there by 10:45 or so.
Yeah.
Then the line would have, it already comes out of the lobby area and up the side of the building. If it was wrapped behind the building, you had to start to worry.
Yeah.
Like if you were behind the building, if you got somewhere, I mean, you could usually get there when they're about halfway to the back of the building. If you've seen Revenge of the Nerds, when they burn down when the Alpha Betas burn down their house.
Yes.
And they take over the freshman dorm, and then they come into the dorm, and all the kids that aren't rushed, didn't get into rushed fraternities, all the nerds, and they all say, okay, go grab a bunk. And everyone goes running to the bunk carrying yeah. their luggage and everything. That was when they opened the door.
I have a story about that that affected me the next year. We get in line. We make it in the theater. There's only three of us, so we can find seats. Mm-hmm. And we found the three seats that we would essentially, until the end of the North years, sit in. Or the row we would sit in. I have that chair today in my house.
You tore the chair out.
I went and bought it when it closed. The aisle seat of that. I think of that row.
How much did it cost?
$10.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, it was a deal.
Wow, I was.
We come in that theater, and I'd never been inside the theater. And, you know, if you had never been to the Drexel North, there was a real funky, like, 70s wood paneled vibe about the place. Mm-hmm. The colors in the lobby were kind of weird. There was, like, teal and red, but it was this.
It wasn't weird, though, back then.
No.
Because that was typical of an independent movie house.
And it was this huge lobby, and there were decorations, and there was the Creature from the Black Lagoon, a papier-mâché version of him. Mm-hmm. And some other stuff. But then we went inside the theater. And I remember going inside the theater, and it was like, wow. I don't even know if it was the biggest theater I'd ever been in, but it was the first time in my young life that the size of the theater registered for me, mm-hmm. where I thought, this is a big theater. And the place is already three quarters of the way full. And there's music playing from other science fiction films and things like that. And the atmosphere when I walked in, it just hit me like, this is something different. Because I just thought, oh, it's fun. Even from the stuff I'd read, I always thought, it's fun. A bunch of people get together. They watch some movies. It's kind of cool. And that's it.
Oh, it was an event.
No. Yeah. Going in for the first time, not knowing what to expect, was stunning. Because you're like, this is like a living, breathing organism. This whole thing. It is truly the ideal of what people talk about when they talk about the communal experience of watching films together. This is like you're being absorbed into this amoeba or something, you know? And I remember going in and us getting our seats and looking around. And I always bring this up, but I will never forget it. Someone pulled a beach ball out.
Yeah.
And they started banging it around the theater, and I thought, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah.
It's a movie event where there are this many people, and they throw a beach ball, and it was like a huge party.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of knocked aback, like already 10 minutes in, before the show even started. I thought, whoa, this is way better than I thought it was going to be already.
Yeah.
And then Bruce gets up, and I didn't know if he was Bruce or Jeff at that point. It took me a year to figure that one out.
This is back when Bruce looked like Reggie Bannister.
Yes, with the ponytail Phantasm, and bald on top and all that. So he gets up and does his shtick, and the first film is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original version. This was the year that the marathon was bookended by both versions of that film.
Yeah.
And I had seen this before, but it was fun, and it was like, oh, this is cool to see this again. After the first film, after Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Bruce is talking, and we hear some people say, like, bread, yeah, Night of the Living Bread. And we turn to the people next to us, and we're like, what's that? And they're like, oh, you'll see. And a couple films later, Night of the Living Bread played, and I can't tell you, to be in an audience like that for the first time, when at that point, at the peak of like the bread mania, when
because it was played at the Sci-Fi.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was I think the second year
used to play it both, and the peak bread mania when people started throwing pieces of bread all around during that event, it was like a hailstorm of bread in that theater. It was bonkers, and it was like, if you don't know what to expect, and I had never even been to Rocky Horror at that point.
Yeah.
You don't know what to expect. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
You got to be kidding me. They all throw bread. And it was great because we got it immediately. You know, we hadn't brought any bread, but we picked stuff up from the floor and threw it back and everything. A movie later, someone in the audience kept saying, "Big sister."
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't know what that was. Asked the people next to us, "What's that?" And they're like, "Oh, you'll see." And of course, we saw Gravity for the first time with Big Sister, and some of you haven't seen it, so I won't give it away yet. And I remember the second film, I think it was the second film, was a surprise, and it turned out to be 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which was a movie I loved as a kid again, too. And slowly but surely, I'm just getting hooked into this event and thinking, this is really weird. And I remember it was strange because I didn't quite know how to do anything. It was like a marathon running for the first time without training.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how to pace yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you gorge yourself on pizza and carbs and all that stuff, and you start to collapse after a while.
Yeah.
The Abyss showed the rare special edition that features the 20 minutes of extra footage.
Yeah.
That was a huge thing at that point. That film held a special place in my heart because my dad and my mom loved that movie. My dad actually bought my mom a custom-made sweater that said "The Iron Bitch" on it because Ed Harris calls Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio the Iron Bitch, and that was their joke for a long time. And their relationship was kind of like that relationship in the movie. I vividly remember during The Abyss looking over in the aisleway right next to me, and there's people laying in the aisle straight up.
Yeah.
Straight up,
that's
watching
what people
the
would
film.
Do.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
People would lay in the aisles. They'd go in the back. Because in the theater, kind of like how the Drexel, I mean, the Drexel's a teeny tiny microcosm of it. But there's that little, there's a little bit of room between the backdrop and
the
entrance.
The bathrooms were in the back of the theater.
But
literally.
They were in the back of the theater. And then there was this ledge that people would sit there and they'd eat pizza up there. They'd stand up there. And you'd have sleeping bags. And I mean, it looked like, you know, a homeless. You know, it looked like you're walking through Central Park.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but again, that was such the appeal of it was like, wow, it really is. It's like the Woodstock of movies in its own little small.
There'd always be the Leaning Tower of Pizza.
Yes, the Leaning Tower of Pizza. The Domino's boxes.
It was all Domino's boxes, which you can kind of do now, but I mean, it would always inevitably collapse at some point.
Yeah.
But that was the appeal of it. Yeah.
And you go and they're showing trailers for movies you've never seen. The Delicatessen trailer, I still remember.
Yeah.
Which the squeaking bed scene. And you don't know what that is at my age. And you're like, wow.
Well,
this
and even then it was relatively new. It
fairly
was,
obscure. Yeah, yeah. That was like,
cause that played, I think it played early 90s. That year or something like that.
Yeah, Delicatessen never played at a marathon until we showed
it. No, played at the Drexel.
Oh, at the Drexel. North. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And back then the trailers were not as, Bruce did not program all the trailers back then. The projectionists handled more of the duty. So you'd get a mix of like genre trailers, but you'd also get some trailers for things that were playing at the Drexel North coming up. There's more about that. I'll tell in a few minutes or next time if we run out of time here. So this was just like kind of an amazing event. Because I was not ready for the marathon setting, like running a marathon.
Yeah.
By the time you get to around midnight, I remember it was the Mysterians. I start crashing out a little bit, and it's getting harder to stay awake. And my life is completely the opposite. When I was young, most people, it's like you should be able to stay awake till all hours. I wasn't. Now, not that I'm like ancient or anything, but now I can stay awake till the cows come home.
I've only stayed awake through one marathon, all the way through.
Wow.
And that was, here, I'll even find it here in a second. It was the fifth. It came from the Drexel North, which would have been in 1991.
With the thing.
That is the only time I've ever not slept at a marathon. I always would crash out.
Well,
at some point.
And there are so many complicating factors that go into that.
Well, especially back then, I was in college then, so I'd have to drive home on Friday night. From college.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then I'd drive home either early Monday morning or late on Sunday night.
I didn't drink coffee at that point. I, like you, I brought a cooler full of Coke
Yeah.
And some Slim Jims. I survived on Slim Jims for the first few years. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea.
You're the one who ruined the bathroom
for
everybody.
I must have, yeah. I must have. And you know, again, loading up on carbs, it's like the classic thing. Hey, let's order a pizza. Yeah. And hey, let's have a sandwich. Yeah. And some more Coke. And all of a sudden, you just die.
Yeah.
I didn't learn how to become like a Zen master of marathon diets until years later.
Well, I learned a lot. Like I said, there's only been one that I stayed awake for the whole thing. And again, I was like 20 yeah. when that happened. Yeah. I wouldn't be able to do that now. And I've learned that just there are times when I'm just going to sleep.
You know what I loved about the marathons? And anyone who knows me out there who's listening to this will either laugh or say, no shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I was really, I don't think I knew how to express it at that point, but it's so obvious looking back. I, as most people who know me, have a deep masochistic streak in me. Deep. In all permutations and sources of pleasure that involves. Yeah, obviously from the fact that I keep coming back here. The marathons were perfect for that.
Yeah.
Because they were an endurance test, and it was the punishment and the pleasure at the same time. I joked about it, the Scorsese connection, you know, yeah. But there's some truth to that. The whole sacred and profane connection Scorsese got from the church and from film. I think about the Drexel North and the marathons, and that completely ridiculous nature of doing the marathons, but that desire to have something that takes you out of your life like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to express that back then. But I know that's what I got from that. So I crash out for the first part of that sci-fi, or the second part of that sci-fi, and I missed Plan 9 from Outer Space. I saw like 10 minutes of the dark half. And I later
that
went
was
back.
The premiere.
Yeah, yeah, it was. I later went back and saw it again.
The girl I knew in high school was in that movie.
Wow, really?
Yeah, she was the at the stop and rob that he stops at.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you lonesome tonight.
Mr. Was it whatever his name was? There was a phone call. That was her one line.
To this day, whenever I hear Are You Lonesome Tonight, I think of The Dark Half, the movie, yeah. Because that's the song that plays when George Stark comes in.
Yeah.
Well, and the cool thing about this was I was missing out on watching some of these, but the seed was being planted inside, which is ironic because that's the tagline for the 1978 Invasion Body Snatcher.
Yeah.
Is the seed, like from outer space from it outer came, space, the seed will be planted. Or
and it will grow. Yeah, yeah. Something like that, yeah.
So we get around to the third to last film, and that's RoboCop 2. And I always bring this up as a perfect example. I said it at the marathon this year of that's the film you play third from last because RoboCop 2 is not a great film, but it's slam bang, kind of mindless action, and it's perfect for that time of the morning.
It'll keep you up if you need to be kept up, but yeah. You know, if you miss it, the world's not going to end.
And I woke up completely. The next film was supposed to be Battle Beyond the Stars, but it kept breaking, famously. Because the print was crap, and they never finished the film.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking out of the theater that day, and there was a styrofoam cup with the broken pieces of film from Battle Beyond the Stars in it that you could take if you wanted. So anyway, we're rolling along till the end, me and my two friends, and we get to Invasion of the Body Snatchers 1978.
Yes.
Now, I had seen this film, I later learned, in parts before on TV, but I always just thought, oh yeah, I've seen most of that, I kind of get it. I was not prepared for watching it all the way through finally for the first time. Now, there's a spoiler here. If you don't want to hear it, like, cover your ears for a couple seconds.
Yeah.
Although the film's from 1978, so come on.
You've had a chance.
I had never seen the ending.
Yeah.
And so you get to the end of the film, and it, you know, they've all been scattered to the wind as the pod people take over. And Veronica Cartwright is there the next morning walking in Union Square, I think it is, in San Francisco. And she sees Donald Sutherland, and she's learned not to show her emotions, but she knows it's him and he's okay, and she runs up to him and he turns to her for 1 second and you think he's okay, and then you see the look in his face and she realizes they got him, he's a pod person, and he looks at her and does the pod person scream, and it cuts back to Veronica Cartwright's face, and Veronica Cartwright is so fucking good in movies at looking distressed. And then it cuts back to Sutherland from that like three-quarter shot underneath him doing the scream, and it cuts to black. It
goes right into his mouth.
Yeah. Then it's black into the credits.
Yeah.
And that's the end.
And then you get up and go.
And it was such an amazing kick in the nuts to have that as the ending of the marathon. Years afterwards, my friend Josh and I would talk about this with awe, with reverence, that like, what a way to close that event, to have such an apocalyptic ending. Today, I haven't talked with him in quite a long time. We would probably still share some kind of common experience because of that. Yeah. And I remember walking out of the Drexel North to be, his mom was going to pick us all up and take us home. And I had really enjoyed the marathon. but I'd been tired, and that ending to that movie was like the seal that had been placed on top of the experience for me, and I thought, oh my God, what did I just go through?
Yeah.
Like, this is crazy. Like I liked it, but all of a sudden I'm realizing, oh wow, things have changed. Yeah. That summer, I became obsessed with the Drexel North. I mean, I used to have dreams about the Drexel North that summer because, again,
you're doing a tear in your basement.
Yeah, well, huge surprise to people that know me. I also tend to be kind of an obsessive person sometimes. I like to think I've tamed that into socially acceptable means over the years, but I like to tell myself a lot of things. So I knew all of a sudden I found a new home. I've said over the years, it was like finding the new home I didn't know I was looking for.
Yeah.
And the new family in some ways, or a second family I didn't know I was looking for. And I knew the horror marathon was coming that fall. And I thought, well, shit, I like sci-fi, but I love horror movies. I have to do it now. There's no way in hell we're missing the horror marathon. So that summer, I keep checking back with the theater. I would call the theater and say, do you have any news about the horror marathon? No, we don't have any news yet. Blah, 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 blah. And again, I would have dreams about the theater that summer because it was like a kid finding a new drug, literally.
How old were you for this one?
16.
16, okay. So that was about when I was.
Yeah.
I was,
and you know how it is too, especially when you're that age and you get your something gets its hooks into you.
Oh yeah.
You live for that.
Usually most normal 16-year-old kids focus their attention on some girl at school, ride by their house, call her, hang up.
I was
not you.
I was different.
It was a movie theater. Harsh mistress.
Yeah, the Drexel North to this day is still the only building I get misty about.
Yeah.
So finally, the word hits that the horror marathon is all. And not only is it my first horror marathon I get to attend, but it's like catching up with all the years of stuff I wasn't allowed to see because there's The Shining, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Exorcist, Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness, Halloween. It's all these films I've heard about as a kid that I was never allowed to see, and now I get to see them.
Yeah.
And if sci-fi was the gateway drug for marathons, the horror marathon was like black tar heroin.
Yeah.
It was so, and it was like black tar heroin, like any kind of serious addiction. There was like a limiting effect to it. I don't know if that's the way to put it.
But it doesn't give you AIDS.
No, thank God, no. there was always a little bit I couldn't have because
you do sound like an addict.
Yeah. Well,
what was your methadone?
No,
at
because
this point?
Oh, I don't know. I'm trying to get on methadone right now. Trust me for this thing.
It's like I got taking a VHS me a long player. Time.
I couldn't go to the whole marathon because I was in marching band, as I mentioned, and it just so happened that the weekend of the horror marathon was our marching band contest, one of the three we went to in the whole damn year.
Yeah.
And it happened to be in Tecumseh High School in Springfield, Ohio, an hour plus away. And I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. No, there's no way. So what I had to do was I showed up at the horror marathon with my friend Josh and one other guy. I vividly remember that morning driving to the horror marathon, listening to the old Brady Bunch album.
It's Time to Change.
Yeah, the when they released, they released all those recordings
winter
they did for the show.
Turns to spring.
Yeah. He had that on his car.
Ba-da-da-da.
And we got there, went in. The Shining was the first movie, and 20 minutes into The Shining, I had to leave.
Ooh,
pissed me off because I'd never seen The Shining before. I had no idea what The Shining was about. Yeah. I just thought. I remember Jack Nicholson's face.
Well, by that, 20 minutes in, you don't know what it's about
either. No, I just remember seeing Jack Nicholson's face as a kid on old, like, cable guide ads and being petrified of it.
The one through the door.
Through the door, yeah. So I have to leave after 20 minutes. I'm pissed, but I'm like, all right, fine. I have my brother pick me up, drive me to the school. Then we go back up to Springfield to the band contest. We get off the bus, we warm up, we do the performance. I've already arranged this before. And right after we get done, I get rid of my stuff and I hop in my brother's truck with a good friend of mine. Well, someone who had become a good friend of mine. At the time, she was a girl I knew who just wanted to go, so we didn't know each other that well. But yeah. we became like best friends over the years. She still works on the marathon decorations today. We drive back and we get back to the Drexel North right in time for the Midwest premiere of Return of the Living Dead Part 3.
Oh, wow. It's not a good movie, though.
Underrated. That's another day, another discussion
for
another day.
You get to see Mindy Clark's boobs.
You do. Yes. And that was a pretty cutting edge thing in terms of like bondage and fetish.
Well, the self harm,
all the piercings and all that stuff. Yeah, that was kind of ahead of its time. I had missed a Chinese Ghost Story part, or a Chinese Ghost Story and Night of the Living Dead. Not that big of a deal because I'd seen Night of the Living Dead many
times.
Chinese
Ghost Story was a really nice surprise.
I had always heard that was like a huge thing, and I'd missed the end of The Shining. No. But I got back. And I'm really excited because obviously I'm hooked at this point. And not only am I hooked, but you gave me a little more and then you took it away a little bit. So I'm even more hooked. I get back and go into Return of the Living Dead 3, The Exorcist, never seen that before. Blew my mind. First 20 minutes, I thought, this has to be a different film. This is, where's the pea soup? Yeah. Exorcist, Kronos, the Guillermo del Toro film.
Yeah. Captain Kronos.
Carnosaur. No, not Captain Kronos.
Oh, okay.
Dumbass.
You can bite my ass.
Carnosaur, Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness, Halloween, what was supposed to be The Devil Rides Out but turned into the something-something premiere of Ticks, another Brian Yuzna production, and
with
Texas
Amy Dolenz.
And Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I was awake the entire time at that point. And, yeah, I mean, I keep using drug metaphors, but it was true. That horror marathon... There was no going back after that point. And it was not only a great horror marathon, it was a great primer for me, being 17, to get to finally watch a bunch of these R-rated classic films I'd never seen before. And I think back to, like, if I had gone to the marathons before, I'd have been introduced to other things and different things. And I don't know that 1993 was, like, the best of those classic lineups, because I think a few of them are more varied and well-versed.
Yeah,
but at that time in my life, to go there... And to see that lineup and that construction of that lineup, the impact that had on me was monumental. And I was beyond sold at that point. And the marathons were part of my life all of a sudden.
Well, and it is the first time you see stuff. Like, I was talking about The Horror of Dracula. And I wouldn't call that the best Dracula movie ever made. I wouldn't call it the best Hammer movie ever made. But it's so impactful because it was the first time. And the thing is also back then and even into the 90s, sort of most theaters just showed current releases.
Yeah.
And the only time you really had a consistent chance to see anything old on the big screen would have been like the Kappa Summer Movie Series, go down to the Ohio Theater. This was a unique opportunity. When I saw The Haunting, because I was talking about The Haunting, I remember that one. That's a vastly different movie. And the screen, you have to understand, the screen at the Drexel now is big.
Yeah.
It's a big screen, but it's puny compared to the one at the Drexel North, because the Drexel North, you had to be able to see it, you know, 700 people back.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing these things on the big screen. You talk about an Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that last shot, which I'd seen many times, never on the big screen. You don't get vintage prints shown all that much anymore. And even though it's nice to watch stuff in the comfort of your own home, you know, back then the opportunity to see a theatrical presentation was rare.
And I think, from what I've heard from local theater historians, I think at the time, the Drexel North had one of the bigger screens in Columbus.
It was very large. Yeah. I saw an X-rated movie there.
Hey,
I've told you about that one.
This was Pretty Peaches? No,
that was Pretty Peaches. Yeah, and the anima scene kind of just shut everybody up. Everyone's just like, quiet.
Yeah.
Spray. But no, this was Blonde Emmanuel. They showed called it NC-17, but it was a 1970s porno in 3D.
Yeah, yeah.
Packed with high school kids.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Awkward.
I'm sure. It's weird, like, if you look on our websites at horrormarathon.com and scifimarathon.com.
Nice plug.
If you look under the archive section, you'll see pictures of the Drexel North.
Yeah.
The pictures of the inside of the house don't really do it justice. Some of the videotapes that I am in possession of copies of now do, to a certain extent. There's more of a three-dimensional effect with that, but some of the pictures make it seem like it's not that big of a house.
Well, you look at it, and because it's deep.
Yeah,
it's deep. It's not wide. Now, the Drexel's wide. Even when the Drexel was one screen,
it was wide.
It was wide. This was deep. It was like the Grandview or Studio, but four times as large.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And to be, especially to be in that house with that many people.
Yeah.
It seemed epic. It seemed mammoth. It was an ocean of people, if you think about that. And, you know, someday we'll finally get our shit together and assemble some of the video footage we have into a way where people, like people who've never been there, can see how huge this was.
Yeah.
So 1993 was my, that was my first year for that. And those back-to-back marathons completely wrecked me for a long, long time. They turned me onto movies. I think one of the biggest things that, I got out of that marathon experience was the variety, the breadth, the depth of the lineups. Yep. Made me really turn myself onto breadth and depth of film in general.
Yeah.
And it opened up those doors for me that, all those things could coexist. And that was a huge thing for me. And again, the impact was huge. I'm getting the signal from Kevin that we're starting to run low on time. I thought we'd get through more of this at this point, but obviously.
Told you it would not happen.
Well, and I have this crazy memory too, and you have a good memory. So, I guess what we'll do is we should do this again, right? We should continue.
Sure.
We can do Drexel North Part 2. Well, and this is what I thought. Drexel North
We could do the transition years. That might be good.
I think we should. There's still more to talk about the Drexel North.
Sure.
This deserves more than that.
Yes.
And we'll get around to the other stuff eventually.
Sure.
But we will. Next time we'll pick up with Kevin's. Kevin can fill in some blanks between his first one and my first one.
I'll be shooting blanks.
You will be shooting blanks too by that point. And I will begin telling you about 1994, Schlock Around the Clock, and the infamous science fiction marathon where history could have changed, where if something had gone another way, I wouldn't be talking with you about these today. But it didn't, and now I'm here.
Until next time!
We will see you then.